So it's nice to see there's a fair number of the Dynamo Theory participants here. When I come to America and I start driving, I say to my wife, if I seem to be driving on the wrong side of the road, don't assume I know what I'm doing, please.
The right side of the road.
please tell me I'm doing something wrong to avoid a fatal accident. So for the Dynamo theorists in the audience, if I seem to be doing completely the wrong thing, then please pipe up and say, no, that's not the induction equation or whatever. So, okay, I'm from the University of Leeds, and for those of you who don't know, here's a map with all the major cities in Europe on. And this is where Leeds is, which if you're from England, you don't really realise that Leeds is really right in the middle of the UK, because we tend to discount all this stuff kind of north of here. Sorry, Keith, I was just joking. Okay, so what I hope to do today is to give you an idea of the sorts of arguments we're having in our program. So I'm going to start off by using the projector just to show a few observations, and then we'll get onto the basic theory, and I'll just finish by outlining some of the problems we're having. And some of the problems will be familiar, especially to those people who are in the climate program. The kind of problems we're having are probably similar to the kinds of problems you're having. I mean, We have a large number of spatial and temporal scales that we have to somehow get some equations for, and probably most of the problems we're having is to do with trying to understand what's happening on large scales without really understanding what's happening on small scales, trying to get global models of planets, stars, galaxies, galaxy clusters, without really knowing very well what the small scale physics is. The problems we're having having sat through last week's excellent talk, are probably very different from the problems you're having with the Large Hadron Collider. I think it's fair to say we know what the equations are. We just can't solve them, okay? We know what the equations are to a certain extent. Maybe that's not true in galaxy clusters. But don't ask me about galaxy clusters because I don't really know anything about them. But we know what the equations are, we just can't solve them. So let me start with some observations. And of course, we're all aware, those of us who went hiking at the weekend, which I didn't, I sat by a pool, you find your way around using a compass, and the Earth has a magnetic field which is largely dipolar. This is a map of the Earth's magnetic field projected back to the core mantle boundary, which is the edge of where we believe the Earth's magnetic field is being generated. And you can see, although it's largely blue, meaning one polarity of magnetic field in the northern hemisphere, and yellowy red in the southern hemisphere, there are patches where the higher order moments can be seen, and we have this spatial structure that we see in the Earth's magnetic field. Now, the Earth's magnetic field has been around for a long time. This is a map, essentially, of the reversals of the Earth's magnetic field. So black is one polarity, white is another polarity. And you see, going back to millions of years before the present, that the Earth's magnetic field has flipped fairly regularly, or fairly irregularly, depending on your take on this, over the last at least 160 million years before the present. And this is the kind of behavior that we're going to want to try and understand. Where does this magnetic field come from? What gives it this spatial structure? And why does the Earth's magnetic field flip every, I don't know, million or so years? That's something we don't really understand, though.
Is that region between 80 and 120, is there no data, or did it really not flip anymore?
It didn't flip.
Didn't play. So this is pretty irregular. This is pretty irregular.
It's called the quiet period.
It's called the quiet period. Let's hope we get some quiet periods in the talk. Anyway. Okay. 0.3 to 0.6 Gauss at the Earth's surface, apparently. Okay, if we move further out, then there are other planets that have magnetic fields with varying strengths. I've put some of the strengths here. Jupiter is the strongest magnetic field, it's about 10 Gauss. It's interesting, when you prepare a talk like this, you actually learn some new things. And I managed to learn that Uranus and Neptune have some fairly wacky magnetic fields from the point of view of dynamo theory. Not only this picture shows the rotation axis and also the axis of the magnetic dipole, So for Jupiter, we're not doing too badly. Both the rotation axis and the magnetic axis run through the centre of the star, and they're inclined at about 10 degrees to each other. That's pretty similar to the Earth, where they're inclined at about 11 degrees at the moment. Saturn, from the point of view of dynamo theory, it's almost for some reason, for reasons I'll explain later on, it's almost something that shouldn't be there. The rotation axis and the magnetic axis are almost aligned. And I'll explain in a minute why that's very difficult for dynamo theorists to explain. Well, it's not very difficult, but it provides a puzzle. But Uranus and Neptune, the magnetic axes do not even go through the centre of the planet. And this I didn't realise, and I guess it would be quite hard to explain. But those people who are experts on planetary dynamos probably know a lot more about this than I do. Okay, I don't really know much about planetary dynamos. I do know a little bit about the sun. I tend to work on the solar magnetic field. So in the early days of movie making, there was this guy, Galileo. He got in on the act. And if you put all of Galileo's drawings of sunspots together, if I can do this, you get a nice movie. Okay, there was a Galileo sunspot drawings. I'll do it again. And you can see that sunspots rotate. Here's the rotation axis. And largely with the velocity of the underlying plasma of the star, of the sun in this case, Galileo, of course, didn't know that these were manifestations of the magnetic field. It took another 300 or so years for Hale to look at sunspots. And this is a modern day, this is, if you like, Galileo 15. You've seen the first movie, now see the actual movie from space. And this is a similar one where now the rotation axis is up here. And these are active regions seen at the surface of the sun. Here, perhaps you can see that these active regions emerge with bipolar magnetic field. Black is magnetic field coming towards you, and white is magnetic field going into the star. So if we look here, one can see some nice features. The magnetic field in the northern hemisphere, at least at this epoch, we have a white sunspot and a black sunspot, whereas in the southern hemisphere, we have black preceding white. And this is a manifestation of Hale's polarity law that says that the orientation of the magnetic field in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere are of opposite signs. Okay. Interestingly enough, this magnetic activity has a large systematic component, which is one of the things we're trying to understand. So if every time you see an active region, essentially you put a dot on a latitude time diagram, okay, this is going back to the mid-19th century, you can see the famous butterfly diagram of solar magnetic activity, where magnetic activity tends to start at mid-latitudes, and as the solar cycle progresses, sunspots are found closer and closer to the equator until that cycle dies out, and then the next cycle starts at mid-latitudes again, and this wave of magnetic activity migrates towards the equator from mid-latitudes. That's not all. If one goes from one cycle to the next, I said that maybe you have one polarity in the northern hemisphere and another in the southern hemisphere, then the polarity flips. Okay, so there's a global flip of the sun's magnetic field every 11 years, meaning we have a 22-year magnetic cycle. So whereas the Earth's magnetic field flips every million or so years on average, this magnetic field flips every 11 years. And again, that's something we'd like to understand. Here is, now if you're not really bothered about the spatial distribution of sunspots and you just plot the 11-year solar cycle, you can see that there's a nice 11-year cycle here, but this is fairly, if you looked at this from a time series analysis, you'd say it was a fairly chaotic time series. The envelope of activity is modulated on a long time scale, and there's this very interesting period during the 17th century called the Maunder Minimum, when very, very few sunspots were observed at all. And this is not because people weren't looking, but really there were very few sunspots. People were looking actively, especially in France. And if we assume the French knew what they were doing, which is always a bit of a rash assumption. Right, so that's the Scots and the French so far. Yes, Anik, I can see you there. Yes. then we can take this at face value. And in fact, if you look at proxy data, beryllium 10 stored in ice cores, which is a proxy for magnetic activity on the sun, then you can see that going back at least 20,000 years, that these so-called grand minima are recurrent events. So solar magnetic activity did seem to switch off every 300 or so years. Going back into the past, and if you count forward, you can see that we're probably due another Maunder minimum sometime soon, which may be interesting for those of you who do climate, you know, because solar input to the climate may change somewhat in the future.
Does that coincide with the little ice age?
It does. Well, there we go. So those people, again, of interest for those people in climate. This coincides. This coincides to some extent with the little ice age on Earth, and has led some people to postulate that solar input on climate may be bigger than you might have first thought. I'm not going to say any more on that because that's a very dangerous. When was the little ice age? And then I can tell you. I mean, it could be that the little ice age is causing the Maunder minimum, of course. Yeah. Okay.
No. but it's the deepest
part of the ice age.
So,
There are a number of people who look at this bit of increasing solar magnetic activity and argue that global warming is nothing to do with greenhouse gases, but due to this change here. It turns out that most of their research is sponsored by like Exxon or Mobil. You have to be a bit careful what you say. So I should just like it said that I do not agree with that hypothesis. Oops. So right now. Okay, moving on to other stars. The sun is just one star. There are so-called solar-like stars, which one can measure the calcium emission from, which is a measure of magnetic activity. And you can see that there are various stars that also show cyclic behavior. These are stars with similar rotation rates, masses, and all of that to the sun, called solar-like stars. I once went to a meeting where there was a discussion as to whether the sun was a solar-like star. Decided that it was, but only just. And so these are similar stars, and you can see that there are periods in the magnetic activity of, you know, roughly 10 years. There are some which show shorter periods, some which show longer periods, and these are quite well correlated with the inverse Rossby number, for those of you who know what that is, saying that rotation rate does affect the magnetic field, at least the period of the cycle. The very rapidly rotating stars, shown here, again, one can detect, in this case, directly, magnetic field, and it takes a very different form. It's very strong polar spots that you tend to find in rapidly rotating stars, and this gives some indication. It looks fairly similar to the magnetic field of the Earth, and it's not really surprising that these are rapidly rotating objects. The Earth is a rapidly rotating object, so maybe stellar physicists can learn a lot from geophysicists about the nature of dynamos in rapidly rotating objects. I hope that this program, that's one of the things we can learn. Okay, galaxies. This is where I'm going to get into trouble. Okay, galaxies also have magnetic fields. Here are some observations of various different galaxies, one seen face on and one seen edge on. Okay. My knowledge of galaxies is very limited, so I'm not going to say very much, except to say that, again, large scale, which is important, and fairly large magnetic fields can be observed in virtually all galaxies. And again, we're trying to understand how these magnetic fields are generated. Okay. Getting even larger and larger scale, galaxy clusters of galaxies. Again, one can have a look at a galaxy cluster in white light and in X-rays, so this is the X-ray emission, and then have a look at the Faraday rotation, which is a measure of magnetic field, essentially detecting magnetic fields. And these three pictures are all of the same coma cluster. And again, a large scale and fairly large systematic magnetic field is seen in galaxy clusters. And again, the question is, where does this magnetic field come from? The idea of this program was to bring together astrophysicists, geophysicists, fundamental physicists, and experimentalists to try and understand the nature of dynamo theory. So, very, very recently, experiments have been performed to try and get dynamo action on the Earth. This is actually quite a difficult technical problem for reasons I might get into later on. Here are just three of the most recent experiments. This, in some sense, is the most successful one, despite the fact it's French, I should say. This is the VKS dynamo experiment in Cadarache, and it seems as though they have dynamo action, they're generating nice magnetic fields, even magnetic fields which show some similarities with the geomagnetic field, right? Which seems to be oscillating, oscillating, reversing, oscillating, oscillating, reversing. This is essentially a washing machine. And it's a washing machine with an electrically conducting fluid inside. It gets stirred up with some propellers, and they try and measure the magnetic field. This is a 3-meter sphere. So this is going to be 3 meters of liquid sodium rotating around very rapidly. So I don't think people will be standing that close to it whilst it's going. At the moment, they're still testing this apparatus with water, which seems like a sensible thing to do. But this is going to be an experiment that is more like the magnetic fields generation mechanisms in stars and planets because it has the correct geometry. And this is something which has just been designed to work. This is the Riga dynamo experiment where again, electrically conducting fluid is pumped up in a very special way and then back down again in a way to achieve as good a dynamo action as possible. So again, we're bringing, especially in June, the experimental physicists along to try and talk to the rest of us so we can work out, again, what's going to be going on.
What was the fluid in the
UKS? Sodium? Liquid sodium. So you don't want this thing to leak.
Yeah. I just ask, is the Earth's background magnetic field eliminated from the experiment?
It's very, very hard to eliminate the Earth. And this is why, okay, those of you who know about bifurcation theory, they always get imperfect bifurcation because they can't eliminate the Earth's magnetic field. So you might say it's not a dynamo, it's just being amplified. The Earth's magnetic field is amplified. And it's quite difficult to differentiate between the two. I mean, some people say that everything's an amplifier. There's just one field line running through the universe and things amplify.
Well, it's possible. You can do a couple of coils.
Right.
And eliminate the magnetic field. You know, of course, more money.
Yeah, these things are quite expensive. These are not the biggest machines in the world, but they're quite big. So, yeah. Okay, so that's the end of that bit of the talk. So.
To actually arrange to simulate something that you think is going on in the
group? Oh, well, no, of course not. No, I mean, the parameter, as I've come to, the parameter regime that these guys are working in is not the same parameter regime as the Earth. But hopefully we will learn something about the nature of dynamo action from these experiments. Inside this sphere or inside? It's not obvious what amplitude magnetic field one will get out a priori.
Right.
The magnetic Reynolds numbers, well, I'll come to it later on, for these experiments.
It's generated in experiments typically 100 times in the Earth.
Right, but it's hard to predict that before you do the experiment.
If it's actually much larger, then
why do you worry about the Earth's magnetic field? Because there are these things called amplifiers. So it might not be a dynamo. It might just take whatever magnetic field has been given to it and amplify it. And that is actually different from a self-excited dynamo, even though one is significantly larger than the other.
I would not quite agree with this because you can really do the imperfect bifurcation in the sense that you also can amplify the opposite sense of the magnetic fields. You can amplify both senses and therefore prove that it's really
I'm confident that these are dynamos. All I'm saying is that you need to worry about this extra magnetic field that's there. And perfect bifurcation thing.
And of course, there is a synchronous machine.
Right. Okay, so if we can get this to work. Ooh, that wasn't a good plan. Okay, so at this point, all the people who are dynamo theorists can go to sleep, if you weren't asleep already. And so I'm just going to give a brief introduction to dynamo theory and what are the problems? So what is the fundamental question? Well, those people who work on, I don't know how we switch. What's the projector?
The other one.
Oh, and the other one.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So our fundamental question is, what is the origin of these magnetic fields? Why are they still there? So another way of asking that question is to say, how are they maintained? If one does an order of magnitude estimate for the Earth, this is the best case scenario, order of magnitude estimate for the natural decay time of the Earth's magnetic field, then you get an answer of about 10 to the 4 years, depending on the length scale you take. And I showed you that the Earth's magnetic field has been around for a long time. It reverses on a time scale of 10 to the 6 years. And so the Earth's magnetic field has been there a lot longer than the Ohmic decay time. So something must be maintaining the Earth's magnetic field against the Ohmic dissipation, against the dissipation. So the first question you would ask is, how are they maintained? And then, what shapes the spatial and temporal evolution? And it may be different depending on whether you're considering a planet, an experiment, or a star, or a galaxy. So for most of these objects, the theory, I think it's probably uncontroversial for most objects that I talked about, is that these are maintained by dynamo action. I think the most controversial of the objects that I talked about as to whether it's maintained by dynamo action or not would be a galaxy. I think there are still people arguing about whether it's a primordial field or a dynamo-maintained field for galactic dynamos, but for galactic magnetic fields. For the Earth, I gave you very good reasons as to why there must be a dynamo. For the Sun, for example, the Ohmic decay time of the Sun is something like 10 to the 9 years, which is about the lifetime of the Sun. So you can't just argue that there must be a dynamo maintaining the magnetic field of the Sun. However, if it was a fossil field that was there at the time that the Sun was formed, then it's very hard to explain the fact that it flips every 11 or so years. So that's the reason why we think there's a dynamo in the Sun. For galaxies, it doesn't appear to be flipping. It just seems to be sat there. Ellen's going to tell me why it must be or mustn't be one in the galaxy.
Well, I just want to make a comment that, as you said, there's no direct evidence for flipping, but the interstellar gas in galaxies turns over about every billion years due to sources and sinks. And so the need to continually remagnetize that gas is, I think, the best argument for a galaxy.
So it's working against turbulent diffusion.
Turbulent. It's just that it's new material. Material's being added and taken away, and it's got to be brought up to a steady state.
Okay.
With the sun, do you know the field reverses right the way through? Have you got a front field in the middle?
Indeed, there may be some field in the middle. It may be an imperfect bifurcation in the sun as well. There may be a field in the middle which has collapsed with the sun, and we think that magnetic field might be quite weak, though. So the kind of magnetic fields that you're seeing at the surface of the sun, we think are stronger than the magnetic field that you get as the star collapsed. Okay, so...
Is there some scaling of the field strength?
Well, no, not really. I didn't measure anything of it. So the kind of magnetic fields you see in sunspots are of about 1,000, of the order of about 1,000 Gauss. And we think that there may be a magnetic field deep in the sun of the order of about 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 Gauss, something like that. And we were talking about microgauss in galaxies, 10 Gauss in Jupiter. There's no scaling, really.
Yes, even at the level of the planet, people try to scale them, didn't work. Every object is a surprise.
Even within solar-type stars, people are already putting things onto two different branches, three different branches.
No, but there must be something to do with the kinetic energy that you have.
Yeah,
and that is just the magnetic energy. So,
but even for objects with similar kinetic energies, there are a wide range of magnetic energy. Mm-hmm. You can get.
The magnetic energy greatly exceeds the kinetic energy, which is a surprise too.
In the case of the Earth, not in the case of the sun.
Yes, I hope not.
I'm thinking there.
Okay, so when was dynamo action first put forward? Well, in 1919, Larmor wrote his famous paper entitled, I should get this right, how could a rotating body, such as the sun, become a magnet? And I think this is the first paper which really nails down dynamo theories away. This was one of the possibilities that Larmor suggested. And, well, what is dynamo theory? It's essentially a competition between advection and diffusion of the magnetic field. So let me just explain how we get the relevant equations. So we're quite happy with these equations. So we combine the pre-Maxwell equations, i.e. we neglect the displacement current. We're not going to worry about things travelling close to the speed of light, because most of the things we worry about don't travel close to the speed of light. So we're going to look for non-relativistic solutions of Maxwell's equations with Ohm's law for a moving conductor. And this is... let me just write out what it is. This links the current to the conductivity, the electric field, the velocity of the fluid or plasma U, and the magnetic field. Okay. Now this is an approximation. This does not have the same standing as Maxwell's equations. And indeed in, say for example, the corona, the solar corona, and probably in the halos of galaxies, then this breaks down and you need to use some other plasma physics formula. But for most of the regions in which dynamo action takes place, this is a good approximation to what's going on. Certainly in collisional plasmas and in electrically conducting fluids, then this is liquid metals, then this is a good approximation. So when you combine this with Faraday's law and Ampere's law, I won't go through the derivation, you get an equation. You can eliminate the electric field, and you can get an equation just for the magnetic field, for the evolution of the magnetic field in a given flow U, okay? So this is evolution, rate of change of magnetic field B, and there are two terms, one that looks like curl of U cross B, and one that looks like essentially curl of eta. Eta is the magnetic diffusivity of the medium, which of course varies depending on whether one's interested in the Earth, or an experiment, or a star, curl B. If we make the further assumption that eta is a constant, which of course it isn't, then this takes on its familiar form. This is called the induction equation. So dB by dt is curl of mu cross B plus eta del squared B, where I've used the fact that div B, the divergence of the magnetic field, is equal to zero. Okay, so there are two terms that contribute to the evolution of the magnetic field B. This one is more familiar. This is just a diffusion. Okay, so there's a diffusion of magnetic field. So in the absence of current, in the absence of velocity U, then dB by dt is eta del squared B, and everything is just determined by a diffusion equation. And it's that equation that you solve to find out that the diffusion time for the Earth is something like 10 to the 4 years. And the only thing that can maintain magnetic fields in the absence of that can maintain magnetic fields is a velocity U. And it's that induction that's going to come to the rescue. Okay, so this is called advection. And it has stretching in as well. Stretching of field lines. And this is diffusion. Now, there is an analogy that's often drawn for incompressible fluids. If you take this equation and you take the vorticity equation of normal fluid mechanics, then they're the same equations, except the vorticity equation has a forcing in there, usually. And so there are lots of analogies between MHD, the induction equation, and vorticity dynamics, which are often used in dynamo theory. So the question then is, how can you get a velocity field, or can you get a velocity field U, for which B doesn't go to zero? We're interested in maintaining these fields against the action of diffusion or dissipation. So is there a velocity field for which B squared does not tend to zero? Okay. So for a dynamo, we need the average of B squared not to tend to zero as t tends to infinity, okay? Which looks kind of easy. All we have to do is solve this equation for a given u. You can give me u. Question can be, can I find a u for which b doesn't tend to zero? So just stretching, we're now over diffusion. So it sounds easy. But unfortunately, the subject was plagued for years by what are called anti-dynamo theorems. So, so the two most famous ones are Cowling's theorem and Zeldovich's theorem. Cowling, 1934. So Larmor was in 1919 posed that this could work. Cowling in 1934 came up with a grave problem for dynamo theorists, which was that an axisymmetric magnetic field cannot be maintained by dynamo action. Okay, an axisymmetric magnetic field vanishing at infinity, but okay, we'll take that as given. This is already a problem, because essentially it's telling us something about the field. A field that is generated by dynamo action cannot be very simple. In fact, there are other variants of this theorem in two dimensions, Cartesian coordinates, that say if the magnetic field is too simple, in this case meaning less than three-dimensional, then it cannot be maintained by dynamo action. And you can imagine what this did to the field, because it's only recently that three-dimensional computations have become available. So, you know, there was a long time between 1934 and indeed and when we figured out when that there were velocities U which could lead to growing magnetic field B. I should say that this equation for a given U is linear in the magnetic field, and so one can look for solutions that are growing or decaying exponentially with a growth rate sigma. So can we find a growing magnetic field, i.e. one which does not decay? Well, I think it's fair to say that it wasn't until the late 1950s that anybody had anything that even looked close to a solution where B squared did not tend to zero as T tends to infinity.
What did Lamar actually show?
He just suggested that this, essentially this term would be important. Up till then, nobody really even thought about the problem. Okay, so this solving this equation to find a growing field is called the kinematic dynamo problem. You take U as given, it can be your favourite flow, it can be as simple as you like, although not too simple, and you look for solutions of B that grow. Of course, U is not really given in experiments, in the star, in the planets. U arises as a solution of the Navier-Stokes equations. The equation of motion for a fluid. Okay, so I'll write it up again in I think its simplest form. Okay, so for the climate people, this is a very familiar equation, hopefully, at least for some of them. This is the rate of change of velocity, du by dt plus u dot grad u, the effective derivative. And there are various other terms. So it's this like F is equal to ma. This is the Coriolis force term. Which, of course, is important in very rapidly rotating objects. There's a pressure term. There's a viscosity. And this term here is the Lorentz force term, where the magnetic field acts back on the fluid that's trying to maintain it. I've put everything else in F. So any other forcing you can think of, be it thermal forcing, buoyancy forcing in the case of a star or planet, or propellers in the case of an experiment, or supernovae explosions in the case of a galaxy, or whatever we think is driving the flow, I've just put in F. Okay. We have that U solves this equation. Once we know U, we can put it back into this equation to find B. If we start off with a very small B, we can see whether it grows or decays, but eventually it must get to a stage where it becomes important enough to act back on the velocity that's causing it. Okay. So F can arise from propellers or buoyancy or it can arise from potentially arise from rotation in the case of disks or supernovae explosions or whatever you like. So what is the main problem we are having, or we have at this workshop? I guess it's the same problem that lots of people have. The main problem that we're all arguing about is that for most of the objects I've talked about, trying to solve this equation, we're in a parameter regime where the flow is going to be turbulent. Okay. And this is true of climate. or whatever. So in all, in nearly all the examples I've given you, parameters are such that the flow is turbulent.
So what are the exceptions?
Okay, I'll come to that in a minute. So if one calculates the Reynolds number, which is going to be familiar to all those of you who do fluid mechanics, but not, which is a typical velocity scale times a typical length scale over the viscosity, for these flows, I've managed to try and work out what these things are. So for experiments, depending on the size, but the Reynolds number is approximately 10 to the 7, I believe. For the Earth, the Reynolds number is about the same. These are fairly large numbers. For the Sun, the Reynolds number, depending on where you look, is about 10 to the 13. For the galaxy, the Reynolds number, I believe, is about 10 to the 7. And this is something I learnt preparing this talk. The galaxy clusters, the Reynolds number is, you think, they're very, 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 very big. So it must be huge. For galaxy clusters, the Reynolds number is 1. There you go, something you learn. And the reason is because the density is so low. The density is so low. So, anyway.
How do you define a viscosity of a galaxy cluster?
He was Candy, how did you find it? You sat next to
him. No, it's just a script set that you represent.
I mean, let me think. Like we said, there's probably some debate about this. But it's not 10 to the 7, right?
But magnetic one, when you quote that, you
okay, well, the magnetic one.
I'll tell you what the problem is.
Okay, I'll tell you what the problem is. Okay, so virtually all of these are in a regime where the flow is very, very turbulent. And
clusters are very, very, very hot. And the viscosity depends on the temperature to a high power. So the mean free path is very long, and that makes them very viscous.
Okay, I guess my question was really directed at whether everyone now agrees you can treat these things like galaxy clusters as fluids.
Well, I think there's some debate about that as to what you should be doing in galaxy clusters. Because, as I'll show you, the magnetic Reynolds number in galaxy clusters is huge. I mean, huge. Think about the biggest number you're going to think of. Double it, add your birthday, it's bigger than that. Bigger than that. Okay. So as if this weren't bad enough, most other parameters are in a difficult regime.
It's not fluid, it's a gas. It's an observed, it's a gas.
Yes, I agree with Keith. So most other parameters are in a difficult regime. So for example, for the Earth, I think it's fair to say that most of the difficulties in understanding the Earth's magnetic field is because it's a rapid rotator, and rotation plays a very important role in the dynamics of this equation. So we had a discussion on Friday about what was called magnetostrophic turbulence. The Earth is rotating so rapidly that you can neglect most of these terms and balance essentially this one, and this one, and that's called magnetostrophic turbulence. And what is the nature of turbulence in a rapidly rotating system? So for the Earth, the Ekman number, which is this non-dimensional number, is about 10 to the minus 14. So this is rapid rotation.
When you say rapid, do you mean rotation rate relative to any term or time?
Okay, so that's measured by the Rossby number.
I understand. So when you say the word rapid, what do you mean?
Both. I mean, relative to a turnover time and relative to a viscous decay time. For that case.
As there might be climate people here, it might also be worth mentioning that the core is very deep compared to the atmosphere.
Right.
Which is actually a big numerical problem.
So the core is very deep compared with the atmosphere. For dynamo theories, there is this parameter called the magnetic Prandtl number, which I'll get this the wrong way around, I usually do, which is nu over eta, okay? So the ratio of the two diffusivities that I've put, if you divide through by rho, mu over rho is nu, the ratio of those two diffusivities in the Earth is about 10 to the minus 5. Now you may say, why is this a problem? This is mainly a problem for experiments. Although the fluid is very, very turbulent, the actual magnetic Reynolds number, which is the ratio of this term to this term, is not that large. It's only of the order of 100. Typically, to get dynamos to work, you need magnetic Reynolds numbers of the order of 100. So, especially for experiments, and the Earth to a certain extent, there's a debate about whether you can get dynamos to work in this regime with a very small magnetic Prandtl number. For the Sun, again, the magnetic Prandtl number is very small, depending on where you look. It varies between two very small numbers. And for those people doing numerical solutions of this equation with thermal forcing, and you need to take account of the energy equation, the Prandtl number is also very small, which leads to problems solving the equations. So those two are in one parameter regime. In the interstellar medium, I believe the magnetic Prandtl number is 10 to the 11, so that's in the opposite parameter regime. So here the magnetic Reynolds number is very, very, very large, whereas the Reynolds number is just very large, okay? So one is very large, one is very, very large. And for galaxy clusters, the magnetic Reynolds number is a staggering 10 to the 29, which is a number so big that you have to not believe it, I think. Which tells you that the magnetic Reynolds number is absolutely huge. For those dynamo theory experts, if you ever wanted to justify doing fast dynamo theory, you should start doing it in galaxy clusters. Fast dynamo theory is dynamo theory in the limit of essentially this term going to zero, but not equal to zero. And so this is the best example that you should be citing to do fast dynamo theory. Actually, just to say, you shouldn't be citing these. If the magnetic Prandtl number is less than one, you shouldn't. Even though the magnetic Reynolds number is very high, they're not. You shouldn't be doing fast dynamo theory for the Earth or the Sun. Okay. This is a wacky board. Okay. So I'm going to finish. I have 5 minutes left. Just by saying, given all these parameters, What are the problems we're arguing about? Sorry, discussing. Okay. Because the flow is turbulent, it tends to want to generate magnetic fields on a small scale. Yet, virtually all of these objects have magnetic fields on a large scale. Okay, so turbulence is very, very good at generating magnetic fields on a small scale. The question we're trying to answer is, where does the large-scale magnetic field of the Sun, that thing that you saw flipping every 11 years, come from? So, flow is turbulent. Turbulence generates small scales. You can see that if you put a small-scale velocity u in here, it might be easy to get a small-scale magnetic field b. The question is, how can you get a large-scale magnetic field b from something that's turbulent and has a lot of energy in small scales?
But turbulence has all scales.
It does. It does. Turbulence has all scales. But if the energy is significantly peaked on some scale, L, the question is, how can one get a magnetic field on a scale larger than that typical peak L? And there's a theory for how this is done. It's called mean field electrodynamics. And one of the originators of mean field electrodynamics is, I'm very glad to say, is sat in the audience and is coming to our program, Karl-Heinz Rädler. And there are some issues, I think it's fair to say, to do with mean field electrodynamics that 40 years after it was put forward as a way of getting large-scale fields, we're still arguing about. In fact, I'd say we're arguing more now than we were then. But there's a whole branch of... It's essentially a turbulence closure model, and we're trying to work out whether it works or it doesn't. So how do you get a large-scale magnetic field? Okay, so the flow is turbulent. It may be rapidly rotating. So rapidly rotating stars, for example, rotate with a period of about a day. So similar to the Earth. The Earth rotates with a period about a day. So these will be rapid rotators. So if it's rapidly rotating, then the question is, how can you solve this equation? What is the nature of the turbulence? I was at a dynamo meeting a few years ago where, again, geophysicists and astrophysicists got together. And Chris Jones, who's meant to be my co-organizer here, said, the difference between geophysicists and astrophysicists is that the geophysicists have solved this equation and they're now worried about this equation, and the astrophysicists can't even solve this equation. So if you want to know... if you want to know the difference. So it may be rapidly rotating... In which case, what is the balance in the Navier-Stokes equation? Again, if the Ekman number is tiny, then rapid rotation, you might expect, in the absence of magnetic fields, flows to a line that's Taylor-Proudman column with the rotation axis. How does the magnetic field break that alignment? What is the nature of turbulence in that limit? If you're at low magnetic Prandtl number, okay, so the Earth is, the Sun is, actually experiments are in the same parameter regime. A question that a number of people have been interested in is, can the dynamo survive? And let me explain why. What I mean by that is, if you're at low magnetic Prandtl number, then you have a dissipative cutoff for both the flow and the field. Scales smaller than the dissipative cutoff will be damped by dissipation. If you're at low magnetic Prandtl number, then you have a scale on which the magnetic field will tend to be damped, and a scale on which the velocity will tend to be damped. Okay? And at low magnetic Prandtl number, this is at large, much, much larger scales than this. But the question you can ask is, given that your velocity field is doing something like this, if you believe in sort of turbulence, well, it's turbulent, so it's going to be doing something like that, how can you generate a magnetic field, which is presumably doing something like this, in the presence of all this stuff which is fluctuating and essentially acting as a turbulent diffusion for this scale fluid? So can you? So what is the role of these scales? And that's something which we really don't know. Is there a closure for that? Can one do any sensible numerics? At the minute, just to say that the numerics that are being done on this are something like 2,000 cubed, and they're separating this by about a factor of 10. So they're not really even close to answering the question. Yes, of course. Sorry.
Before we get into all the problems, did you show us that there was a dynamo?
No, I kind of... Oh, you're a stickler. Yeah. Okay, so I should say that... Okay, by the late 50s, then people were coming forward with velocity fields that worked. And now it seems like almost any velocity you put forward will work as a dynamo at high enough magnetic Reynolds number. The problem is that, on the whole, they generate small-scale magnetic fields. I think that's... So we don't have any problems getting fields now. because computers have advanced to a level where we don't have to look for axisymmetric fields or 1D fields. We can do 3D calculations. I should say that one of the issues we're facing is the role of computational physics. Dynamo theory is really bad from the view of the computational physicist in the sense that if you under-resolve a dynamo calculation, you get a dynamo when you shouldn't get a dynamo. Okay, and that's really dangerous. Okay, if you don't get the dissipation correct, you get the wrong answer, and it's the wrong answer which makes you go and publish. Okay, it's that way around. You say, "Ah, I've got a dynamo," and then somebody years later comes along and says, "No, actually, you haven't." And dynamo theorists know this. I should say, in the accretion disk community, we have a discussion on dynamos and accretion disks, and one of the collaborators, maybe I shouldn't say this, one of the collaborators wanted to entitle his talk "Accretion Disk Dynamos, 15 Years of Crap." Okay? They're all under-resolved, though. They're nearly all under-resolved. So you have to be very careful, very careful. Okay. Nearly finished. I said that if we could solve the equation I've just rubbed off the board, you would get an exponentially growing field. So if one plots log of b squared against time, for a given velocity, the field will grow exponentially if it's sufficiently complicated. And then the magnetic field will act back on the flow via the Lorentz force here, and everything will saturate. So you'll get something that looks like this. So this is the saturated state, and this is the exponentially growing state. The question is, what determines the amplitude of this state? And again, that's quite a difficult problem because it will depend on the nature of the turbulence that's generating the field, on whether it's rotating or not rotating. In particular, can you get the amplitude of this state similar to the kinetic energy that's in the flow? Okay. Usually people come up with equipartition arguments, but it's quite hard to get dynamos that get anywhere close to equipartition.
Have you been able to see that
numerical
saturation?
Yeah, so this has been seen numerically for not very turbulent flows. And now people are trying to get scalings and things like this to try and understand what's going on. Okay, so finally, energy sources. So in certain cases, there is no problem with having enough energy to drive the flow, which will drive the magnetic field to the observed value. Okay. So for example, in the sun, there's an awful lot of energy available. We don't really work in a tight energy budget. But for the Earth, there's a very tight budget to try and get the observed magnetic field. And so we're going to have some debates as to where does the energy come from for the Earth. For experiments, there's also a very tight budget, but that's essentially comes from funding agencies. If you give them more money, they will have more power to drive their experiments. And so these guys, they measure their power in dollars. Actually, they say, you know, the power needed to drive this is $20,000 or whatever. So, no. Okay, without any, somebody tell, how much does the DKS experiment cost? A lot more. But not, I mean, it's still measured in milli large hadron colliders. Let's put it that way.
I think it's called micro.
Maybe micro. Yeah. Yeah, millions, yeah. And so we could talk about value for money, I guess. Okay, so last week we finished with what we know and what we really know. So what do we really know? So I'd say one, astrophysical objects, and I'm including the Earth as an astrophysical object, have magnetic fields. And that's it. That's what we're So, thank you for your attention.
You always mention the magnetic field outside where you have the foam field.
Not necessarily in experiments, they can.
No,
yeah.
That's what I mean.
Mm. Or in the galaxy, you measure it inside the system.
Yeah. In the galaxy, really looking.
And there's still large hair. You sort of intuitively think that you don't have large hairs outside.
Well,
is that wrong?
Well, from the point of view of the Earth, of course, the magnetic field is decaying, and of course, the dipole is the least decaying, the least.
Right.
And so, of course, you're seeing the magnetic field at the surface to be larger scale than the magnetic field in the interior. And you can
so we don't know in the interior if it's large scale in the interior.
Well, it's less. The picture I showed is the magnetic field at the core mantle boundary, which is where it's the boundary where we think the field is being generated from the core. And so it's not as large scale.
And the velocity field should be much smaller scale than that?
For the Earth.
Yeah.
I think so, because the Reynolds number is very high, but the magnetic Reynolds number is not so
high. Yeah, early on in the talk, you discussed the misalignment of the magnetic axis and the rotational axis. What do you know about the problems associated either with the total alignment of the two or with the large misalignment?
I can talk more about the total alignment. So I wrote down Cowling's theory, which said an axis and actual magnetic field can't be generated by it. Now, of course, as we just said, we're only seeing the large scale component, which is pretty much axisymmetric. But presumably, the small scale field is not axisymmetric, it has to be. And so it's kind of what you see and what you don't see again. But for the other planets where there's a complete misalignment, I don't really know what that means.
I was wondering if you what theoretical or observational evidence you could use to determine finally whether magnetic or primordial magnetic fields actually exist in galaxies. So, for example, if we were to consider the problem of star formation in this context, if we start with some actually symmetric protodisk, which would then collapse, in that scenario, wouldn't the anti-dynamo theorem prevent dynamo-generated magnetic fields? And if you found that you needed magnetic fields, wouldn't that argue for primordial ones? I just was wondering how you could proceed.
Although the anti-dynamo theorem was really important from the point of view of making people think that dynamos were really hard, if one could only see, say, the large-scale components of the field, then that can be axisymmetric. But when you have turbulence in a disk, say, that will make small scale non-axisymmetric. And at that point, the anti-dynamo theorem is gone, we're okay. One of the great strengths of mean field electrodynamics is that it enabled people to just derive equations for the large scale magnetic field, which could be axisymmetric, and so everybody could do things. But we swept under the carpet all the small scale dynamics that we didn't really understand, which was presumably non-axisymmetric. That's what you do in turbulence collisions. You get all the stuff you don't like.
Some of us still spend our time under the carpet.
There's nothing to say. Sorry.
So people often will mumble these words about the similarity of the energy densities of the galactic magnetic fields and the galactic cosmic rays. From the point of view of dynamo theory, is that just that would just be totally have nothing to do with each other?
Though. Okay, I shall defer the question to the words cosmic rays came in and knocked on my eyes. I'm a mathematician, I don't know anything about physics.
I don't think we have a complete explanation, but I think the best explanation is that magnetic fields, interstellar turbulence, and cosmic rays share a common energy source, namely supernovae. and current theories for the acceleration of cosmic rays suggest that a few tens of percent of the shock energy should go into cosmic rays, and that's comparable to the amount of energy that is available to drive turbulence. And then Steve has just explained how magnetic fields tend to come to equipartition with the turbulence. So I think that's the best we can do at the moment.
And you are your guys.
Of course, you should just mention that the CMD has the same energy density.
That's not the full Mandel balance.
So back to biggest object, galaxy class. Right. The reason I use the word gas for the fluid, I meant it's not a Knudsen regime. The mean part is still smaller than the object. And you actually pack the galaxies. If galaxies you buy, you have to buy clusters of galaxies. And the second emotion, since you consider you limit yourself as the biggest object in galaxy of clusters, you couldn't answer Susan's question, what about this primordial field, creationism, whatever, where the hell it could come from? Then a question becomes, can universe, forget about galaxies and so, create a magnetic field itself? And then isotropic universe cannot, because there's no direct, any direction. You have to spontaneously break. It boils down to field theories. When I was younger, we tried to crack this problem, but stuck with again, maybe like Higgs, something should be broken in the universe to create a direction which will be your primordial field. If you come up with some ideas of that sort, then you close the scales. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much.